The Jericho Network on Westwood One.
All right, it's Friday. You have downloaded Talk is Jericho, and it's Stanley Cup playoff time. So let's talk some hockey with Hall of Famer Phil Esposito, one of the greatest players of all time. That's what I'm talking about. What a huge, huge guest today. 18 years on the ice with the Boston Bruins, Chicago Blackhawks, New York Rangers. We're talking center ice with Phil, scored 76 goals in a season back in like 1971. He was one of the greatest of all time, and he's an amazing guest. But first, I got to tell you about GoDaddy. GoDaddy wants to help you get your business online. Their website builder makes creating a website easy, even if you don't have any tech skills. Just choose a design from their hundreds of customizable templates and then personalize it with a website builder's drag-and-drop design tools. That's how easy it is. Bing, bang, boom, you're done. Woo! Just drag and drop. And for $1 a month, you get everything you need to create a professional website with unlimited pages, including free domain name, free hosting, and GoDaddy's award-winning 24/7 support. Just $1 a month? Are you kidding me? A pencil costs more than that. Go visit GoDaddy.com and enter code Jericho to get Website Builder for just $1 a month. That's promo code Jericho. Some limitations apply. See the website for details. GoDaddy.com. Go, go, go.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He's a world champion wrestler,
best-selling author,
actor,
and lead singer of Fozzy.
Now
he's rocking the podcast world.
Marvelous.
This
is Talk is Jericho.
Talk is Jericho,
starring Chris Jericho.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho, the pot of thunder and rock and roll. The People's Podcast has arrived. Let's go for a ride. Somebody's going to get their ass kicked. Somebody's going to get their wig split. Somebody's going to get their ass kicked. Somebody's going to get their wig split. Beat him up, break his neck, break his neck. Beat him up, break his neck, break his neck. Beat him up, break his neck, break his neck. Beat him up, break his neck. 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 And it's Friday!
It's Friday, Friday, gotta get down on Friday.
What an entertainment extravaganza we got going on today. It's a rock and roll regatta with Hockey Hall of Famer Phil Esposito coming up. NHL legend, 18 years on the ice. Played for the Boston Bruins, Chicago Blackhawks, New York Rangers. 1971 Summit Series, Canada versus Russia. Lots of great stories, lots of drinking stories. Those NHLers like to have a drinky winky from time to time. He is one of the pioneers in pro hockey, one of the pioneers of the NHL. Single-handedly brought the Tampa Bay Lightning to Tampa Bay. Still involved. Plenty of stories, lots of opinions. Very, very cool interviewista. But before we get into things, once again, let me say thank you for showing my sponsors a little love. I appreciate all of you who have gone to PodcastOne.com and clicked on the Keep Our Podcasts Free banner at the top of the page. It's the easiest way for you to find out all the great sexy beast sponsors who make this show what it is, make it possible twice a week. You'll also find the Amazon links there for Amazon USA, Amazon UK, Amazon Canada. It's all good in the hood. In all seriousness, it actually does take some cash to get this show recorded and produced for you for free twice a week. I love doing it. Give me a little bit of a rush. Ooh, what a rush. Talk is Jericho. I want to keep doing it for you for free. So again, please check out PodcastOne.com. Click on the Keep Our Podcasts Free banner at the top of the page and then click on Talk is Jericho, okay? Can you do that for me? Can you do a brother a solid? All right, I know you can. Phil Esposito is on the way, and I'm going to talk about the new Star Wars movie, Star Wars 7. It's amazing. The cast has been announced, and very amazing. I'm really excited because in that cast, Carrie Fisher, Princess Leia, Anthony Daniels, C-3PO, Mark Hamill, Luke Skywalker, and my boy, the man, Han Solo. Harrison Ford will also be there. Chewbacca's going to be there. Peter Mayhew. It's a really good mix of old and new. Obviously, we all know those characters. And I'm really excited about it because I think that the episodes 1, 2, 3 weren't bad, but it's a little bit of a disconnect. If you grew up with the original three Star Wars, it was all about the dynamics and the amazing character of Han Solo and Princess Leia and Luke Skywalker. And the fact they're back in it 30 years later, that really excites me. And apparently J.J. Abrams, who has the amazing task, I don't even know how he was able to do this, he's running the Star Trek franchise and now the Star Wars franchise. I mean, that's a lot of trust. Seems like it might be a conflict of interest. It's like I'm going to be playing guitar for the Beatles and the Stones. But if anybody can do it, J.J., do it. You know he respects what's going on. You know that he understands what he needs to do to reboot this, not even reboot it, to make this the sequel up to snuff. I thought it was one of the best things ever when George Lucas sold the franchise to Disney. We're going to be getting Star Wars movies for the rest of our lifetimes, much in the same way that the James Bond character lives on and has for the last 50, 60 years. A lot of people a little bit trepidatious, but I disagree. I think that it's going to be a very, very good movie. I think J.J. Abrams understands the responsibility and how important it is to keep the legacy alive, to keep the storylines alive, and to get that cool factor back in, because we kind of lost it a little bit on episode 1, 2, and 3. I love that George Lucas isn't involved. He's a consultant, but it's time for him to pass the reins on to some guys that can do that. And Abrams is the best. I mean, I thought Kevin Smith could have been good, but Kevin Smith's a little bit comedic maybe, whereas J.J. is on the ball. Apparently the story takes place 30 years after the Battle of Endor, which is why it's perfect to use those guys, meaning Carrie and Mark and Harrison Ford. And I know that Harrison Ford wanted Han Solo to die in Return of the Jedi, so I think that you're going to see the demise of Han Solo in this movie. Now, the subtitle, a lot of rumors, what could it be? Apparently, the number one rumor that I heard was that it's going to be called The Ancient Fear. Star Wars 7, The Ancient Fear. I don't know. But who are the new cast members? Let's go through. Adam Driver, a lot of unknowns. They've got some credentials, but mostly unknown, which is very cool because that's the way that the first Star Wars cast was. Harrison Ford hadn't done much. He was in like American Graffiti in 1942, but he didn't really hit big until Star Wars came out. So we got Adam Driver is going to be in the movie. Maybe a possible dark side of the Force. Maybe he's going to be a Sith. We don't know much about Adam Driver, but he has been cast in apparently a very significant role. Then we have a bunch of other new characters that they're talking about. A lot of names that Daisy Ridley, John Boyega, Andy Serkis, who we know he played Gollum in the Lord of the Rings movies. Max von Sydow also in it, which is perfect. He's kind of like the Alec Guinness of this movie, where he's like a guy that everyone knows, longtime famous star. But what is he going to be? I mean, I think it's wide open. Very, very good choice. John Boyega actually was in Attack the Block. I don't know if you saw that. I believe it was an Edgar Wright movie where they fought, like, you know, aliens and stuff. Daisy Ridley, British actress, kind of just un-British. You know, once again, a lot of actresses and actors that have some credibility, have some. You know, work on their career bio, their career synopsis, on their resume, but we don't really know a lot about them. A couple of people from Downton Abbey, which is a big English show that Scott Ian likes. So, I mean, I know that this is going to be a huge, huge movie, and I'm really excited. Like I said, I don't know a lot about the new cast, but I love the fact that Harrison and the guys are in it. And there's a really cool picture on the StarWars.com website, which I was on the front page of once years ago, and I took a picture of it. It was one of the coolest things ever. And it's all the gang gathered around the table to do their table read, which is super cool. I mean, how rad is that? You can see Harrison Ford. He's got his legs crossed, which Vince McMahon would hate. You see Mark Hamill talking to Max von Sydow. Carrie Fisher's right in the middle of it. You got Peter Mayhew with his long ponytail. They got R2-D2 in a box right on the outskirts. They're all kind of gathered around in a circle. So, very, very cool stuff. I am really excited about the new Star Wars. How do you feel about it? Go to the Twitter, at TalkIsJericho, and let me see your cigarette lighters. No, actually, let me see what you think. Tell me how you feel about the new Star Wars movie and your opinions on how good it's going to be, or bad, if you feel that way. Fozzie on the road. I am currently doing this show, doing these intros on the tour bus outside of the Chameleon Club in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. We have some big shows coming up May 9th in Poughkeepsie at The Chance, May 10th, Hampton Beach, New Hampshire, Hampton Beach Casino, May 11th, Clifton, New Jersey at Dingbats, May 13th, New York City at the Gramercy Theater, May 15th, Arlington Heights, Illinois, Chicago area at the Home Bar, May 16th, Pontiac, Illinois at Freaksters Roadhouse, and then, of course, May 17th in Columbus at Rock on the Range. We just played, our last festival was in Carolina Rebellion. We tore the house down. We were on after Volbeat and before Rob Zombie, and I was scared to think about, you know, how he's going to show up or anybody going to be there. We had an amazing crowd, about 15,000 people. Got to see the debut of a new Jericho lighted jacket. Yeah, and this one is far and above beyond the other two that I have. This one is like an iPhone 5S compared to an iPhone 2. So if you come to see Fozzy at one of our upcoming shows, you'll get to see the debut of the brand new jacket, and it will blow your mind. Get your sunglasses on, because the future's so bright, I got to wear shades. And so do you. And another thing you got to do is beware and get ready and prepare for the summer blockbuster movie season, which has arrived. A lot of great action, superhero, and horror movies coming out. You know I love all those type of films. But there's another movie about to be released on May 16th that I'm really looking forward to. A family movie, a Disney movie. Disney movies are always good, especially the Disney sports-themed movies. Feel-good sports-themed movies. They got another one coming out called The Million Dollar Arm. And it's one that I can take my whole family to see. I'm very excited. Feel good. Feel good for the summer. Million Dollar Arm stars John Hamm. He's a great performer. I love him in Mad Men. I loved him in Bridesmaids. Great on Saturday Night Live, too. Super funny Alan Arkin. If you haven't seen Glengarry Glen Ross, go check it out. He's amazing. Bill Paxton is also in Million Dollar Arm. And the lovely, talented, and sexy-wexy Lake Bell. Great name, Lake. I love it. We used to have a tour manager called Luke Bell. She's Lake Bell. Do not get them confused. But the movie's about a down-on-his-luck sports agent, played by John Hamm, comes up with an idea. Wants to find the next American baseball star by running a contest amongst 40,000 cricket players in Mumbai, India. They do an American Idol-style competition, and two guys emerge with a contract to play in the pros. But not only does he have to teach them how to actually play baseball, he has to do it at the major league level, okay? Yeah, you can see hilarity will ensue and heartwarming nuggets of joy. Based on a true story, aren't they all? And I know you're going to love it. I saw an extended trailer. It looks really, really cool. I'm excited about it. My son is excited about it, Ash the Fish Hunter. My family and I are going to go see it May 16th when it opens. You should grab your wife, husband, kids, grandma, best friend, whoever, and go see it too. Take everybody. Auntie Elsie, Uncle Freddy. Uncle Freddy down in Yorkton. Take Toho. Take Chad Halawachuk. Go down there and check out Million Dollar Arm. And go watch the trailer and buy your tickets now at Disney.com Million Dollar Arm Trailer.
Hey, don't be stupid. Now's the time to listen to Honey Badger's Badass Animal Podcast. Don't you know that each week, every Friday, we're going to bring you the world of animals, amazing animal stories, interviews, a whole bunch of fun stuff right to your eardrums. Tune in and tell the world. It's Honey Badger's Badass Animal Podcast. The only place to be to listen to it is right here on PodcastOne.com for animals.
Talk is Jericho.
All right, we are here in the bowels of the St. Pete Times Forum in Tampa. I'm sitting with Phil Esposito, legendary player, Hall of Famer, great scoring legend, everything so much. Glad to have you here.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's good to be here with you, Ben.
Yeah, absolutely. I was really excited to get a chance to sit down and talk to you,
yeah,
especially here in Tampa. This is basically like the arena that Phil Esposito built in a lot of ways.
Well,
you know?
Yeah, that's when they put a statue up for me, and they asked, would you mind if we did this? And I said, would I mind? Of course not. I said, besides, pigeons and the seagulls need somebody to something to sit on, you know? So I was but I always like to throw humor in certain things because it just makes it easier to grasp. And
oh, sure.
For me, anyway.
Well, let's talk about this. How did you originally think about bringing hockey to Tampa Bay, Florida, all places? But back then, it was like bringing hockey to Mars.
Well,
in a lot
basically,
of ways.
That's a lot of people thought I was right out of my skull up north. I was running the New York Rangers. I was general manager, vice president of the Rangers, and 89, I got fired, and I think it was June, the first week of June in 89. Excuse me. And I lived in a place called Bedford, New York. When I retired from hockey, my ex-wife said to me, "It's my turn." I says, "What do you want?" She said, "I want a horse." I said, "A horse?" We lived in Manhattan. You know, we lived on the West Side, 76, between Columbus and Central Park, and a beautiful townhouse. And she wanted a freaking horse. I said, "A horse?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, okay." I didn't know. No matter what, a horse eats the same, whether it's Secretariat or it's a plug. But anyway, so we moved out to Bedford, New York, because I built a house and all that. And when I got fired, I was sitting down in my basement, and I had been on the marketing committee of the NHL as a player and as a manager. I got into the marketing. I love that sort of side of the business. And I knew they wanted to expand, and I was told, I went to the league and I said, "Look, I'm going to try to get an expansion team. I'd like to do it in Florida." And I remember John Ziegler, who was then the commissioner, but he was called a president
of the NHL. Yeah.
He said to me, "You can, but you got to stay away from Texas." I says, "Why?" I said, "Just stay away from Texas." I said, "Well, I want to go to Florida anyway." He says, "Okay." I didn't know Minnesota. Moved to Dallas, and they had already had that in the plans, you know?
Right.
So that's why they told me to stay away from there.
Why were you thinking Florida?
I loved coming down after hockey season's over and spending 2 weeks play golf and just sit on a beach and have a few and relax. It was great after as a player. And so Florida was where I wanted. I went to Orlando first because they had a building. And Pat Williams, who had worked for 76ers in Philadelphia, the basketball team, was running the Orlando Magic. And I went to see him, and he said, "Phil, you're not getting in here. We don't want hockey here."
Wow.
He said, "I had to deal with the Philadelphia Flyers all those years, and I just don't want to deal with hockey." I said, "Well, okay, what am I supposed to do? Say no." So then I went down to Miami. Rich Cunningham was there, and he was also a basketball player for the 76ers, and he told me the same thing. I'm thinking, what the hell did Eddie Snyder do to these guys, you know? and then I met a fellow named Henry Paul. Henry Paul's dad was Gabe Paul, who was president of the Yankees, Cleveland Indians, baseball guy. Tried to get baseball here along with Frank Morsani. And I went with Henry, and we went and talked to Gabe, and we're sitting there, and I took an immediate liking to Henry Paul. And he's a lawyer, so I don't usually like lawyers right away, you know? I have to get to know them before I like them. And I liked Henry right away. And I asked him, I looked him right in the eye, and he was born and raised around here. And I said, "Do you think hockey could survive in this market?" And he looked me right in the eye, and he says, "Absolutely." I said, "Then I'm going to go for it. Are you with me?" He says, "Okay, I'm there." Now, this is the very first time I ever met him. And we were at Malio's, the old Malio's, on Dale Mabry.
Yeah, down in Tampa.
And that's how it started. And I remember he and I putting together the staff and trying to get people together. And, of course, I hired my brother. Because I trusted him, and you needed people in this business. You got to have people you can trust and are loyal and stuff like that. So he, and then we hired the guy that was the chief CFO of Madison Square Garden. His name was Mel Lowell. He was the chief financial officer of the Rangers, the Knickerbockers, and the Round Building, as they call the garden. When I said to him on the phone, I says, "I'm going for an expansion team, Mel. Are you with me?" He said, "Absolutely. I'm there." He said, "Where?" I said, "Florida, Tampa Bay." He said, "Are you crazy? Are you nuts?" He said, "How are you going to play hockey in Florida?" I said, "Mel, you play indoors. Who the hell knows what the weather is like outside? Till you walk outside."
Yeah.
the building's always the same, around 70 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every building keeps it about the same, 68 and 70, mm-hmm. whatever. And I said, when you go outside, when you walk out in Montreal, it's 15 below zero in January. You walk out here, it's 70 degrees. Which would you rather have? And he says, count me in. And that's how this whole thing started.
So when you first announced that you were going to be doing it, was the what was the feedback from the community? Because I've often found, like, when you grow up with hockey like we did, I grew up in Winnipeg, you grew up in the Toronto area, it's part of your it's in your blood, and you love hockey, and that's what it is. But down here, a lot of people don't grow up with hockey. Was it a hard sell at first, or was there such an anticipation of it that people were into it right away?
Well, it wasn't easy, mm-hmm. but people around here like football. They like wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
They like boxing. They like car crashes. I said, hell, we got it all in hockey. And that was my theme, okay, you know? And whenever I went to speak, I would – I remember one time at a Kiwanis meeting here. I asked people, how many people have never seen a hockey game? And about four or five people put up their hand. I says, you're in. I says, we're going to have an exhibition game. I'm giving you tickets. Come to the game. Because once you see it live, we got you.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept pushing that. Once you see it live, we got you. We got you. And one guy said to me, yeah, you won't get me. And after he told me, he said, you got me. You know that. Huh?
Yeah.
So that was my whole game plan. The biggest problem we had was where to play. So we ended up... I couldn't get a lease at the Suncoast Dome, they call it?
Yeah, over in St. Pete.
We call it the Thunderdome now. It's mm-hmm. Tropicana Field. But I forget what it was called.
Yeah, the stadium.
Yeah, the stadium over there. There were two groups vying for the franchise in Tampa. In Ottawa, there was only one.
Mm-hmm.
Hamilton, there was one. But in the Tampa Bay area, there were two of us.
Oh, two ownership groups going for the same team, basically.
Exactly.
Wow.
The Carmanos group that ended up buying the Hartford Whalers and moving them to Carolina. I remember a guy named Rick Dodge,
mm-hmm.
who was, what do you call it, like a councilman over there in St. Pete. And he says, unless you tell me your money, people, I'm not going to let you have a lease. And I said to him, why not? Just give me a lease, give the other guys a lease, and you got a team.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, I found out later he was in the pocket of Al Eagleson, who was the executive director of the Players Association. He was in the pocket of Carmanos. And they were all going against me and trying to get me out of it. They underestimated me, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know about you, but I love when people underestimate me.
That's a challenge.
It's a challenge, boy. You underestimate me and I got you, you know? And I always used to say that when I coached a little bit. I said, don't underestimate your opponent, ever, ever.
That's right.
Never underestimate your opponent. Find his weaknesses if you can, but don't underestimate them because they're there too, you know?
Yeah.
So we ended up not knowing where to play. So when he didn't give us this lease, we're driving back across the bridge, Henry Paul and I looked at him at the Howard Franklin Bridge, and I says, Henry, you're telling me there's no place in this whole area that we can put 10,000 people, because that's all we needed in the beginning.
Mm.
And he said, well, maybe the fairgrounds. I said, where the hell are they? Where's that? So he takes me up there, and it was, remember they used to do the big races here with the cars?
Like
St. Pete does.
Races.
They have. I walked in there, and all these cars were lined up, but there was a path right down the middle. Paul Newman was in a thing, and I had met him when I lived in New York, because I lived in Bedford. He lived in Chappaqua, which was, and his wife was into horses, like my wife was. And we used to sit there going, look at the dollars are flying around here every time they jump. But I remember walking and pacing. I said, hell, we can get 200 feet of ice here.
Mm-hmm.
We can do that. I wonder if I can get 85 foot wide. So I said, Henry, we got to make a lease with this place. He said, how are we going to do this? I said, you're the lawyer. Figure it out. How do we get a lease for this place? We ended up getting the lease for that. And when the NHL flew down here, Chris, this is where you lie sometimes, you cheat a little bit sometimes. When the NHL flew down there, the executive committee, they landed at the fairgrounds mm-hmm. with a helicopter. And they came in, and I had already put the police yellow tape lines, 200 by 85, but I moved the seats all the way in, the way out, I mean, so okay. that you can't, because we couldn't get 10,000 people.
Yeah.
It was 9,400.
Oh, okay.
It's all we could get.
But you needed 10 was the minimum.
10 was the minimum. When they came in, they started pacing it, and they said, well, what about the seats? I said, we can move them in if you want, but they got an event tonight, and it's just too much to do, and you can see we can get 10,000 people in here, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and we got 200 by 85. And they went on my word, and they said, okay. The minute that helicopter left, I moved the rink down to 185, and I put 650 seats on one end, and I put 550 seats on the other end, and we got to 10-3, 10-4.
That was the start.
That was the start. They never knew that it was only 185 feet. But Boston was at the time. Chicago was at the time. Pittsburgh was at the time. Buffalo was at the time. People have no idea. And when you're out in that ice, when people say to me, well, the big ice during the Olympics, you know, 200 feet and went out 210 feet, you don't notice it. You're mm-hmm, on the mm-hmm, ice. Mm-hmm. You're playing, man. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't notice that the ice is bigger or smaller or what have you. So we ended up getting the franchise. And the rest is history, as they
right.
say.
Now, how was it for you, you know, being on the ownership side of things? What was the differences? I mean, you started in 1964.
Yeah, 63.
63 with the Chicago Blackhawks. Now, what was the game like when you started in comparison to the way it was then or even the way it is now?
Well, there certainly wasn't the physical part of it the way it is now in the sense of being in shape.
Mm-hmm.
A funny thing, I just found a letter that I got in 1963 to go to training camp for the Blackhawks. And long story short, they have it in a thing that says, please do not report more than 7 pounds overweight and be prepared to do 20 sit-ups, 20 push-ups, and 30 deep knee bends. And that's it.
That was your training camp.
That was our training camp. I mean, we trained for 6 weeks.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, I'd always show in 7 to 10 pounds overweight. And by the time 6 weeks were over, you were down mm-hmm. to your playing weight or pretty close to it. Of course, it would have been quicker to get there had we not drank as much beer as we did after practices. But that's when it was 10 cents a draft, too. Put a buck on a table, and boy, you were blasted.
So when you started out, who were some of the big guns on the team in the Blackhawks? Like some of the guys
Bobby Hull, Stan Mikita, Kenny Warm, Glenn Hall. I remember my first shift in Detroit. It was I played in Montreal. I dressed. I didn't play.
Mm-hmm.
I would sit there. But it was my first time out there. And Billy Ray said to me, it was in the third period, he says, Esposito, go out there with Hull and Fleming, Reggie Fleming.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was your first shift?
Yeah, and he says, and let Bobby take the face off. So I go out in the ice, and I tell him, I said, Bobby, Billy wants you to take the draw. He said, okay. And I'm looking around, and there's Gordie Howe, Hall of Famer, Ted Lindsay, Hall of Famer, Alex DelVecchio, Hall of Famer, Terry Sawchuk, Hall of Famer, Glenn Hall, Pierre Palat, Bobby Hull, all Hall of Famers, and I'm going, wow. And all of a sudden, Bobby says to me, hey, kid, you got that old son of a bitch? Talking about Gordie Howe. I said, I got him. Puck drops, and Gordie gives me a smack, an elbow, right in the lip here. Cuts me, and I feel the blood. Right off the face-off. Mm-hmm. And you know when you get hit in the nose, just below the nose there, my eyes were watering, and I went, you old son of a bitch. And I swing my stick at him, and we swung it at the hips because that's the only place we had padding in those days. And I get a penalty. He and I go in a penalty box together. I'm 6 seconds on the ice.
First shift ever.
So in those days, you go in first, and a cop or an usher sat between you.
Oh, okay.
So, and I got a towel, and I'm trying to stop the bleeding. And I lean over, and I said, and you used to be my so-and-so idol. He said, what you say, Wapo? I went, ooh, nothing, Mr. Howe, absolutely nothing. And he told me later that he was the first time anybody ever said that he was my idol.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because he said, man, I knew I was getting old, you know. And we got it at penalty together, and he told me later that he tested every rookie that came in the game. And if you didn't respond, he owned you for life.
Right.
Or as long as he played or you played. And I responded, and he never bothered me ever again after that. And he and I, we became pretty good friends. We really did.
You must have had a little bit of a reputation coming in the league. I mean, with as a goal scorer, as somebody to keep an eye on.
Well, Chris, I was lucky. I never made junior hockey till I was 19.
Wow.
People, you know, like Wayne made it at 15, 16. Yeah, Mario and Crosby and all these guys and that score all these goals. I never made it till I was 19. I was a very late developer.
Mm-hmm.
And when I made junior hockey, it was really hysterical. I was 19-year-old rookie, and I'm skating around at the rookie camp in August, and Rudy Pillis was the owner of the Blackhawk junior team, and he was the coach of the Chicago Blackhawks. And they had just won the Stanley Cup the year before. And he sees me, and he calls me over, and he says, hey, you, fatso, come here. I weighed 228 pounds at the time, Chris. I played about 210 to 212 my whole career.
That was fairly big for back in those days, too.
Really big.
A lot of guys
really
didn't get over 200 pounds.
So he calls me over to the bench, and he says, you want a job? You want to play? I said, yeah. He says, you're too fat. I said, well, I'm 19 years old. I mean, how many 19-year-olds make the junior
make the squad?
And he says, well, I'll give you a chance. I'll give you $60 a week. You come back here October the 3rd for the big camp. And if you weigh 200 pounds or less, I'll give you $60 a week. I went home. I told my mom, no more bread, no more pasta, round steak. I ate more round steak than I knew what to do with. And salad, round steak and salad, round steak and salad. I came back in October. I weighed myself in. I weighed 201. And he went, you didn't make it. I looked at him and I said, are you kidding me? He says, no. He said, you didn't make it. I said, come on, man. I busted my ass. I said, you gotta give me a break here. And he says, I'll tell you what I'll do. You got a job, but I'm going to give you $57.50. I'm taking $2.50 for the pound. and I said, fine, let's do it, you know. And that year, I didn't play the first six or seven games. And I worked in the steel plant back home in the Sioux. And
Sioux St. Marie, right?
Yeah, Sioux St. Marie, Ontario. And my dad called me. He was the general foreman of this particular open hearth furnace that I worked in. He said, son, you either got to come back or you stay, but you're going to lose your seniority in the union unless you come back. They won't give you another extension. And I thought, okay. So I went to the coach and I said, I'm going to go home, because I wasn't playing.
Yeah.
I was 19 years old. You know, they were playing the kid. Dennis Hull was on that team, Freddie Stanfield, Kenny Hodge, you know,
it's
all these
really talented
team. They were all young guys, you know. And all 3 or 4 years younger than me. So he said to me, he said, listen, the coach, Kenny Campbell, we're playing an exhibition game against an intermediate team. Ray Cullen, who was our star player at the time, he can't play, he's hurt. I'll put you at center and let you play. I says, okay, and then I think I'm going to go home after this. He said, well, let's see what happens. We win 6-4. I get 4 goals and 2 assists. And next year I was in the NHL.
Wow.
If I didn't get that break, and I wasn't prepared for that break, and I tell kids it all the time, you got to be ready. That's what all the preparation is about.
Yeah.
No matter what you do, you got to be prepared and you got to be ready for that break, because everybody needs a break. You're going to get it. It doesn't know when it's going to come, but you've got to be ready for it. And I was ready for it. I really was. And after that, it was like,
well, you had to be ready too, because it was, I mean, nowadays there's 30 teams in the league or whatever it is, but back then there was six. And it wasn't like there was a bigger roster space. There was a 20-man roster or whatever.
Six.
So if you didn't break in,
it was less.
You might never get in.
Because there were three lines,
uh-huh.
five defensemen, is 14, and one goalie, 15.
Wow.
We didn't have a backup goalie. The trainer was the spare goalie. Yeah.
Wow.
If your goalie got hurt, I remember Glenn Hall getting cut, holding his neck because they cut him. And he went downstairs to get stitches. We held the game up for about 20 minutes. Came back up and finished the game. Otherwise, our trainer would have had to go into the net.
Wow.
I remember one time, too, they called in the audience. Does anybody in the audience play goal?
Really?
I swear to you, it was insane. Of course, I have the stub of my first game in Chicago Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
$3.50, it was on the glass.
Do you remember your, I mean, you scored 700-plus goals. Yeah. Do you remember your first goal?
Oh, absolutely.
What, tell us about it.
It was against Terry Sawchuk. It was in Detroit Olympia. I got a pass by Bobby Hull and Reggie Fleming assisted on it. And I had a breakaway from the blue line in. And I had watched Terry Sawchuk in warm-up because he just started doing all the warm-ups then. Mm-hmm. Because before that, they didn't even do that. He would go down on one knee, his right knee. He would go down on a knee. And so I came in and I faked. He went down on knee and I put it right up over his right shoulder. Remember it as plain as day.
Just like it was yesterday.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Wow.
You never forget that first one.
Yeah.
The last one, I can't tell you where I scored it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But the first one lasts forever.
One, yeah. It's just big, like the first cup.
Of course. What were the circumstances that led you speaking of your first cup, which you got in Boston, what were the circumstances that led you to be traded from Chicago to Boston? Because the Boston was your big year.
I played with Bobby Hull on the line. He scored 50 goals that year, and I scored 27 that year, and then 23. I was a 20-goal scorer.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, that was like a 300 hitter in baseball. And
so you're doing good, but not great.
I was doing okay, but here's what happened. After we had won the championship that year in Chicago in 67, we won first place overall. We were partying in the locker room after,
mm-hmm.
and there was a party upstairs, and Bobby Hull and I and Chico Mackey stayed behind a little bit, went up there, and I had a little bit too much to drink.
Mm-hmm.
And I see Billy Ray and Tommy Ivan. Billy Ray was the coach. Tommy Ivan was the general manager. They both were maybe 5'9", 5'8". Mm-hmm. And I looked over, and I said, look at those little shits over there. They're going to screw this team up. And Bobby said to me, why don't you go tell them? I says, well, I will. And he goes, well, you go ahead. I says, okay. And I started walking over there, and he comes after me. And I walked up to him. I says, you two guys, you two little runts, you cannot screw this up. We got a good team here. Don't mess it up.
Mm.
They looked at me, and Bobby's laughing, right? And he egged me on. And I knew I was gone because I went in to get my expense check home, and I yelled at the secretary, give him whatever he wants. Tell him, make sure he brings all his stuff with him.
Ooh.
Don't leave anything in Chicago. And then on May 15th, which is the trading deadline before the first expansion draft in 1967,
mm-hmm.
I was left off the protected list on the Chicago Blackhawks. St. Louis was going to pick me first. Scotty Bowman was,
mm-hmm.
he told me this many times. He said, you would have been in St. Louis for the rest of your life.
Your career, yeah.
And anyway, Bobby Hull called me at 12:05, which was the deadline. He said, Phil, I just heard you got traded to Boston. I said, get out of here. He said, no. I never got a call from the Blackhawks. Never got a call, nothing. Hmm. Then the PR guy, we used to call him Porky Pig. He looked like Porky Pig. and Porky called me, and he said, yeah, Phil, he said, you got traded to the Boston Bruins, you and Kenny Hodge and Freddie Stanfield. And your ego, right away you say, for whom?
Yeah, right.
You know? And they said, Pitt Martin, Gilles Marat, and a guy named Jack Norris, who was a goalie.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I knew Pitt and Gilles were, because we played against them. And I said, oh, my God, I'm going to Boston, last place team. They had ended up last. And
this is like 1969?
1967.
Okay.
So I talked to Milt Schmidt, who was the general manager of the Boston Bruins, and he said to me, "We're really happy to have you." All that bullshit they say, mm-hmm. you know. And I said, "Look, I want $11,000." I says, "I am not coming and play." He said, "Well, you played for $8,000 in Chicago." I said, "Well, I know, but I got a $3,000 bonus for winning first place. We won first place, and I scored over 20 goals." And he said, "Well, I know, but we can't do that." And we haggled.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, and I told him I'm quitting.
Wow.
Because I was making around $12,000 a year full-time, mm-hmm. driving bulldozers, Euclid, track excavators, working in a steel plant, you know, it was $3,000 to $11,000.
So 11 grand a year wasn't even really all that great money for that time either.
It wasn't. Yeah. I mean, you think about it, that's 67.
Yeah.
It wasn't a lot of money. And especially I had scored three, I had, first year in the league, I ended up 11th in the league in scoring.
Sure.
Second year, 9th. Third year, 7th. So I was getting there.
You're a proven scorer, absolutely.
Right. So we argued and haggled. I went to my brother's graduation, Michigan Tech. And I had told him before I left that I'm not coming to Boston. I'm going to quit. I'm going to mm-hmm. retire, stay here in the Sioux and work. And I get a call from my mom at my brother's graduation. Said, "Milt Schmidt, he's got to talk to you. He's been calling out." I said, "Ah, screw him, Ma. He doesn't want to give me any money. I'm not going to do it. Mm-hmm. No way." I said, "Okay, I'll call him back." Because she says, "You got to call him back. It's courtesy. You got to do it." So I called him back because we didn't have agents or anything in those days.
Wow, yeah.
I called him back and I said, "Milt, I want $11,000. That's what I made last year with the Blackhawks. That's all I'm asking for." And he says, "I can't do that." He said, "But I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll give you $10,000 and I'll give you bonuses." I says, "What kind of bonuses?" He says, "Well, we should start around 25 goals for..." I said, "Why 25? He said, "Well, you scored 23 last year." I said, "Yeah, but I scored 27 the year before and 25 also."
Yeah.
And he said, well, okay, I'll give you 20. $1,000 for 20. I said, "What about 25? He says, "What do you want?" I said, "Give me $1,000 for 20, $2,000 for 25, $3,000 for 30. And I went right up to 50.
Yeah.
And it was...
And nobody had ever scored 50 goals at that point in time.
Well, right? Bobby Hull had.
Oh, Bobby did. Okay.
Bobby Hull had.
But that was the only
and
guy.
And Rocket Richard.
Okay, so there's rarefied air.
I ended up, to make a long story short, I ended up making $24,000 that year. Because
off
I
of bonuses?
Got every freaking bonus. Everyone. And they were going crazy, right?
How many goals did you score your first year with,
49.
With Boston? 49. Your first year?
Yeah.
That's how you do 49. It.
49, and it was like he was, they didn't know what to go. And then the following year, I made points. I says, "I want bonuses for points, all-star team." I mean, I had bonuses if I took a leak somewhere wrong.
We're with Phil Esposito's brothers, Tony, here in the boardroom at the Tampa St. Pete Times Forum, the arena that Phil basically built. We'll be right back. We're going to talk to our sexy sponsors here on Talk is Jericho. More Phil Esposito coming up.
I know that buying a car can be a hassle, and dealing with car salesmen and dealers is never easy. But believe me when I tell you, there's a better way. People! A buddy of mine told me about a new way to buy a car. It's called TrueCar.com. Yes, at TrueCar.com, you can actually see what others paid for the car you're looking for in your area so you know when you're getting a great price. At TrueCar.com, you get a savings certificate, and you just take your savings certificate to a TrueCar certified dealer so you don't need to worry about the hassle and anxiety of the old way to buy a car. And TrueCar users save an average of $3,000 off MSRP. $3,000. That's a lot of scratch. And check this out. TrueCar certified dealers have sold over 1 million cars to TrueCar users. Over 40,000 last month alone. The numbers don't lie. So, seriously, if you're ready to buy a car, why wouldn't you go to TrueCar.com, huh? It's the negotiation-free, guaranteed savings way to buy a car. Save time, save money, and never, ever overpay again. Visit TrueCar.com today.
Hi, everybody. It's good old JR Jim Ross. And, man, what a Ross report we have for you. WWE legend and Hall of Famer, the Heartbreak Kid Shawn Michaels, joins the show this week. Shawn was backstage at WrestleMania 30, and he was there in person when The Undertaker's streak was ended by Brock Lesnar. Wait till you hear exactly how all that went down. Shawn Michaels has got the story and so much more in one of the most provocative Ross reports ever right now at podcast1.com.
Okay, keep your eyes closed.
Okay.
I want to show you my first ever painting.
All right.
Okay. Open your eyes.
Oh, that's a lot of colors and shapes.
So be honest. What do you think?
Well, I like how if you switch to Geico, you could save hundreds of dollars on car insurance.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Here, why don't I hold your paintbrush while you call them?
Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
Talk is Jericho.
So what was it, Phil, that you mentioned that you went from a huge jump of like 27 goals up to 49? Did you have a better line mates with you? Was it a better system in Boston?
Well, there were two things. One, Kenny Hodge and Wayne Cashman got with me, and I don't know what it was. We had chemistry right off the bat. And plus, we had Bobby Orr.
Tell us about Bobby Orr as far as being a pioneer. He kind of changed the game in a certain way, didn't he?
Well, he changed the game as far as defenseman is concerned.
Right.
There's no doubt about that. More like a rover like it used to be in the 20s. Because they always had a rover. Eddie Shore was a guy. They all talked about a rover. Then Doug Harvey. And I'm sure your dad will know these names.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
You will know your dad well. And these guys were good as rovers, but Bobby took it to a different level. Bobby Orr was the most talented hockey player I ever saw play until I saw Gretzky.
Mm.
Lemieux had the talent,
but
Lemieux, in my mind, didn't have the heart that Wayne or Bobby did. Okay. Mario played in the beginning because he loved it. And then it got to be a job for Mario. Wayne and Bobby always played because they loved it.
Did you find, too, that Mario was bigger, so he was an easier target to
Without
hit?
Without a doubt.
He paid the price a lot more.
He did pay the price a little bit more, but he was so smart, Mario. And I think he could have been the greatest of all time.
Oh, okay.
I really do. But he's not that...
Yeah, he didn't have the fighting spirit that Wayne and...
That
Bobby
Wayne
had,
and Bobby
right.
had, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But boy, Mario had talent. Holy cripe.
I mean,
the things he could do with
the
puck were unbelievable. And
but Bobby Orr as well.
Oh, without a doubt. But Bobby, when I watched him, Chris, in practices, I watched him in the games, because he was in the league the year before when I was in Chicago. And I remember him playing against us in old Chicago Stadium, and he played center. And I'm thinking...
Really?
Yeah, and he wasn't very good as a centerman.
So they really moved him from forward to defense?
Well, no, he was a defenseman, but they didn't want him to play defense.
I understand.
He was a kid. He was 18 years old. And so they put him at forward so that he'd get skating because he was such a real good skater. And I watched him. And I tailored my game on how Bobby played and how Cashman and Hodge played. I felt that with Hodge and Cashman, they were so good in the corners to get the puck. They were big, they were strong, and they didn't care how they got it. You know what I mean? And so they were a little mean, which was good. And I figured, where the hell am I going to go here? So I thought, hash marks. Bobby Hull always told me, the greatest spot, when you come to that face-off circle, from the face top of the face-off circle to the dot of where they drop the puck to the net is like a funnel. Think shoot from the minute you get there. And that's what I did. And I would, Hodge and Cashman would know that if they put that puck out by that slot area, which is by the hash marks, and if I was going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And we planned it that way. And I just tailored my game to that style. And people always said to me, well, that's all you did was you stood in front of the net. And I took a goddamn beating.
Sure. That's a tough place to be.
I mean, my back has been operated on a couple of times.
Because you're getting hacked by the goaltender cross-checked from behind.
The way the guys play now in front of the goalies,
mm-hmm.
you played like that with Jerry Cheevers and Billy Smith and Ronnie Hextall.
Mm-hmm.
Your ankles would be toast because they would whack your ankles with those goal stick. They'd break your ankles if they had to.
And it's behind the play, so no one can really see
Nobody could really see it. And it was only one referee.
Oh, wow. Really? No linesman?
You only had one referee. Wow. No, two linesmen. They weren't allowed to call anything in those days. Just
even
the
if
referee.
They saw it.
Doesn't matter.
Wow.
They could say it to the guy in the dressing room in between periods. Boy, oh, boy, the Esposito's taking a whacking in front of the net. But if the referee didn't see it, he can't call it. They can't call it. Now it changed.
Yeah, it has. It has. But you have an amazing squad. Who was the coach?
The coach the first year was Harry Sinden.
Harry Sinden, right.
Harry was the best professional coach I ever had.
Mm-hmm.
He really was responsible for figuring out what and how I could play and utilizing Hodge and Cashman with me. I really believe that.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a lot of respect for Harry. I really did, except for when he traded me to the Rangers without calling me and telling me because I thought I deserved better than that.
But 70-71, obviously, probably your best season ever. You
scored
76 goals.
76 goals.
How many assists did you get that
76.
Year?
76.
So, I mean, you're
152 points.
And that, at that time is
sure,
the
I,
most.
I held it for like a decade.
That's the most ever points in a season up to that point in time. And obviously the most goals.
Well, I was the first player ever to score 100 points.
Yes.
125, now and 150. And
which is incredible.
50, 60 goals. I scored 70 goals, 75.
76 goals.
I had 550 shots a net that year, Chris.
Wow.
And that record still stands. No one ever.
See, and that's the old adage. You can't score if you don't shoot.
And you got to hit the net.
Yeah, 550 shots. How were you even in position to take that many shots?
Because I played almost 35 to 40 minutes every game.
Wow.
Bobby Orr played over 40 minutes a game.
Wow.
These guys play 20 minutes now, man. I'll tell you the truth. The guys nowadays, they're bigger, they're stronger, they're certainly better looking physically than they were, but they don't have one thing. They don't have this stamina because they train for the sprint, not the marathon.
Right.
It's quick, 45-second shift, 40-second, quickness, quickness, quickness all the time. I don't care what business you're in. You can't go all out all the time.
Yeah.
That's why guys go sit on the bench and they have three lines in hockey. You just can't all the time. I mean, in wrestling, you guys know what you're doing. You're very good at it. Christ, I think you guys are great athletes as much anybody I've ever seen. The way you fall and all this other stuff. It's one of you guys don't break necks.
Yeah.
It's amazing, to tell you the truth.
Well, but like you said, you have to pace yourself in the ebb and flow because sometimes we are out there 40 minutes as well.
Absolutely you
are. Some guys can't do that. But the best guys can and have to.
And they have to.
Right.
And they make the most money.
Yeah,
period.
That's right.
And that's the way it is. You know?
How was it winning the first Stanley Cup? I mean, the Stanley Cup is the hardest prize to win in all pro sports because the amount of games you have to win, et cetera.
16 you have to win.
Absolutely. And that's not like that, friend. And it gets harder and harder as we get further into the playoffs. Right. So tell us about that. I mean, what an amazing run for you.
Well, I thought when we beat the Rangers that year, we had won 10 games in a row in the playoffs. I mean, we went.
And you know the Rangers that you beat, my dad was on that team. Ted Irvin was on that team.
That's right.
Yeah. It's the only time
he
ever played in the finals.
That's right. Teddy was on that team then.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, when we could beat the Rangers, we knew it.
Mm-hmm.
We had them. I don't know why we felt we always had them, but we couldn't beat the Canadiens. The Rangers could beat the Canadiens all day long, but they couldn't beat us.
Yeah.
So we would hope. You know, Montreal would beat us, Rangers. And the first Stanley Cup in 1970, we beat the Blues in the finals. But St. Louis was an expansion team, and it was the West against East. And if the Rangers had beaten us in that other series before, they would have won the Cup.
Yeah.
You know? No, St. Louis wasn't going to beat us. And but when Bobby scored the overtime goal, I remember in the dressing room after the third period, we're tied with St. Louis. We're already up 3-0. There's no way they're coming back. We don't want to go back to St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And Derek Sanderson's sitting beside me. And I says, well, Turk, $5. Our line scores the winning goal. He says, you're on. Our line's going to score the winning goal. I said, we're going to start. And you're not going to get a chance. He says, no, no. If they start this Berenson, I got to start. I says, why would you do that? Why would he do that? So Harry comes in and he says, Derek, your line starts. And he goes, get the sawbuck ready. and if, lo and behold, you know, the first shift, Bobby scores the goal, the famous goal of him flying through the air.
So he gets tripped right as he scores. They take the picture.
I got so excited that I tried to jump over it, and I caught my foot on the bench and landed right on my jaw, and I got 3 stitches on my jaw.
Luckily, nobody took a picture of that.
But I was so excited because that first Stanley Cup was something. But we didn't get to take it home. We didn't get to touch it.
Oh, wow.
No, we had it in our dressing room. And, of course, we threw champagne around and filled it with beer.
Yeah.
We were cheap guys, you know. And
Darren McCarty told me it's 17 and a half beers fills up the Stanley Cup.
Is that how many it was?
Yeah, just so you know.
Well, because we were drinking and my dad was there. I remember Bobby's dad, Derek's father. All the guys' dads were in the dressing room, and all of a sudden, we started throwing guys in the shower. And I remember my old man said, don't even think about it because I will hurt somebody. And nobody went after me. My dad was a big guy.
Yeah.
He weighed about 280, and there was no screwing around with him. You know?
That's right.
So nobody bothered with him.
Yeah.
But that was so much fun. I can tell you, I woke up, and I was in Pompano Beach. I don't know how I got there. Bobby Orr, me, Eddie Johnson, and Derek and Jerry Cheevers ended up in Pompano Beach. And Eddie bought all the tickets. And we flew to Pompano and called our wives and said, don't send out. We're here.
Honey, I got to tell you something.
Don't pay the ransom. I'll be home tomorrow.
Well, I mean, you know, this is kind of the golden age of hockey, and it was a different world back then. I wanted to ask you about the Summit Series, 1972.
Oh, sure.
Team Canada versus Team Russia. Now, at this point in time, Russia was like, you know, the Cold War was on, and it the enemy.
Yep.
Tell us about how this even started and what it was like. Because it was the best of 8 series, which is kind of strange.
It was.
But, you know.
Well, that's because of the money that was involved.
Four games in Canada, 4 games in Russia.
In first place, we should have never been called Team Canada.
Mm-hmm.
We should have been called Team NHL.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't let Bobby Hull play, Gordie Howe play, Jerry Cheevers play, because they were in the World Hockey.
That's right.
They were in Winnipeg. Bobby was in Winnipeg.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't allow these guys to play. And I was one of these guys that kept saying, why are we called Team Canada?
Mm-hmm.
We're Team NHL.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If we're going to be Team
That's
Canada,
right.
let's be Team Canada.
And they wouldn't let Bobby play because he had jumped to
the WHA.
And there was a big political problem.
Eagleson was running this whole show. I turned it down twice. Tony and I were doing a hockey school in the Sault Ste. Marie. And I remember Eagleson calling me and I says, no, I don't want to play in that.
Why is that?
They told me it was going to be like an exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
And it's August.
Oh, you know? Right.
And I had to leave on my oldest daughter's birthday, August 14th.
Mm.
And I said, no, I don't want to go to that. And then we got to go to Russia. Who the hell wants to go to Russia? So I said no. Then Harry Sinden called me a week later. And this is in June. They were getting organized to do this. And then he called me in July. And I said, Harry, I don't want to play. I just don't.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, it would be really good. And Harry had left us. And he went to work for this construction company.
Oh, okay.
in Rochester, New York, because he didn't get the kind of money that he wanted as a coach.
Mm-hmm.
So he left coaching. And so I hadn't seen him in a year and a half or talked to him in a year and a half. So Harry called me and I said no. And then about 4 days later, Bobby Orr called me and he said, Phil, I really need you to play.
Hmm.
He says, I can't play. My knees are screwed up, but we really need you to play. And your brother. I says, Bob, I'm going to play because you're asking me.
Wow.
You're my friend.
Respect, yeah.
And I respect you and you're my teammate and I will play. And my brother is going to go crazy because he didn't want to do it mm-hmm. at all. But if I went, he had to go.
Your brother is younger or older?
A year younger.
Yeah, okay.
He had to go, Chris. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If he didn't go, they would have ripped him
apart. Yeah, because he was a huge star too at the time as a goaltender, right?
Got the record for shutouts, 15 shutouts in a year.
Yeah.
He still holds it.
Amazing.
He's a rookie of the year, runner-up for MVP award twice.
Wow.
So they had to play. Mm-hmm. You know, they needed him. So I said, okay, we'll go. I said, but what's it going to be like? He said, it's going to be like an all-star game. It's going to be fun and screwing around exhibition. Well, it didn't turn out that way.
Hmm.
That first game in Montreal, it was 94 degrees outside Montreal. It was, I think, August 29th or something like that. And no air conditioning in the forum.
Wow.
No air conditioning then.
How was the ice?
It was okay, but it was soft.
Okay, yeah. Kind of choppy a bit.
And that first period, I mean, I scored 30 seconds into the game. Clarkie scores about 3 minutes later. We're up 2-0, and then we got a penalty. That first penalty, they dazzled us.
Wow.
We didn't know what hit us.
Had you ever seen the Russian team before? So you never. Didn't realize how good they were.
Never saw them play. Never cared.
Wow. Did you expect them to be as good as they were?
Not at all. Not at all. I found out later in life. In fact, when I've been to Russia now in the last 2 years, 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't been since 72. It was 40 years before I went back. I went in 2012 and then last year. And I got to be friends with Yakushev and even Boris Mihailov, who, son of a bitch, speared me really good. Right into Kalyon's too, boy. Oh, really good.
Wow.
And I never got him back. But I got to be friends with these guys in Petrov. And they told me as 12, 13, 14-year-olds, because they were all about the same age, those guys, they were brought into Moscow every summer for 5 weeks to learn how to beat the Canadians.
Really?
By Tikhonov.
Yeah, the famous coach, Viktor Tikhonov.
And the godfather of the Russian hockey. I forgot his name now. But that's all they did was train from the time they were 12, 13, and 14 to play against us.
Wow.
Now, that's in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So we played against them, and most of those guys were 24 and under. They were kids. Because most of that team played against the Olympics in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
That's
right.
The United States. They were almost the same guys, you know?
Yeah.
So
in their early 30s, and all this other stuff. That's right.
And the first game they ever saw Tretiak play, our scouts that scouted him for this Team Canada 72, he was terrible, they said. He got married the night before. How the hell is the guy going to go? And if I know the Russians, they're face drunk.
Right.
So this kid is 20 years old, 21 years old. And he's was married the night before, and he couldn't stop a balloon, they said. Well, he was a good goalie. For me, he wasn't so good. I had his number because he stayed back of his net. I loved a goaltender that stayed deep. Because I could pick spots.
Yeah, you can pick a corner.
Yeah, I could pick spots. Mm-hmm. I never shot it hard, but I could hit spots. Mm-hmm. And that was my game. And when that first game, what a rude awakening. I got to tell you, I'll never forget us guys going on a charter plane back to Toronto because two nights we had to play in Toronto next time. And I stood up, I got up in front of the plane and I said, listen, guys, we got to do something here to get ourselves in shape.
Did you lose that first game?
7-3.
7-3, right.
They killed us.
Wow. Because you underestimated your opponent.
Totally underestimated.
We talked about that earlier, yeah.
Totally underestimated. So we practiced the next day in Toronto, and I said to Harry Sinnott, Harry, I know everybody's been promised to play. We had 35 guys, Chris.
Wow.
And everybody was promised they were going to play. So we were all supposed to take a game off or two games off.
Yeah.
Which I had agreed to. Everybody had agreed to. And I said, Harry, you can't do this. We got to get a team together. And we got to become a team or we're not going to beat these guys.
Mm-hmm.
If we're not a team, you cannot win individually in a sport that's a team sport.
Right.
And you know what I'm
that's
talking
right.
about. Your dad certainly knows what
Absolutely.
I'm talking about. So I said, we got to become a team. So get our team.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but I still got to play some guys different. I said, then keep the core. I said, I want to play every game. If I can't play every game and you don't want me to, then there's no use me being here because I believe that I could do the job.
Yeah.
I believed it in myself.
Well, you were the best player in the league at the time.
One of the best. So we played in Toronto the next night, 4-1 we win. My brother was sensational.
Stood on his head, yeah.
The first period, they only had 8 shots. 3 of them were breakaways.
Wow.
3 of them were breakaways, and he stoned them. And then Peter Mihaljevic scored one of the greatest goals with a shorthanded. I bank it off the boards. I killed penalty with him, and he just deep Gusarov and went around and put it in past Tretiak. Man, I could see that. And that big son of a bitch, he weighed 245 pounds, okay?
Yeah.
When he scored, I got so excited, I actually lifted him off the ground. And we didn't do weightlifting in our days. You know they wouldn't let us weightlift?
Oh, really?
Do you know we didn't even have water on the bench? Ask your dad.
Really?
They didn't let us drink water.
Why?
They said it would cramp you up. I mean, how stupid is this?
Yeah.
But when we went to Russia... We knew the rooms were bugged. Of course, then we went. I'll digress. We win in Toronto 4-1. We go to Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
We tie 5-5. Mm-hmm. My brother should have never played that game. Should have been Kenny
before.
Again because he wasn't ready to play back to back. We weren't in shape.
That's right. Yeah,
and
different
we were
style.
Getting
yeah.
there, but we weren't in shape yet. So
how
Tony
could you have
played.
A 5-5 tie though?
Well, we didn't have any
no overtime or
no
shootouts?
Overtimes,
wow.
anything else. It was 5-5. Mm-hmm. And so now we go to Vancouver. Harry changes the lineup again. He puts in Billy Goldsworthy, Dale Talon, all these guys. You know, I
get you, man. Good guys, but
good
not,
guys.
It shouldn't have been in there.
Well, they hadn't even played.
Yeah.
We lose 5-3, and the people boo the hell out.
That's right. The famous speech, right,
and
Phil?
And I make my speech. Well, it wasn't. It wasn't planned. It wasn't rehearsed. That's all I know is I got picked as star of the game for the Canadiens. And when I went out there, Chris, there were these three guys behind the Zamboni entrance in the old Vancouver Stadium. And that's where Johnny Esau was, with CBC, I guess he was. They were yelling and screaming, hey, the commies are better. Communism is better. And I wanted to throw my stick at him like a spear. It just made my blood boil. And then when Esau asked me, and I don't even know what the hell he asked me, I just went off. And it just came out. I never saw and really didn't understand what I said for 10 years. We had a 10-year reunion in 1982 at the Molson's Brewery in Toronto. It was a
apropos.
Good reunion.
Apropos.
And... we had a great time.
And basically what you said in the speech for people that don't know is that you went out there and said, this is not fair, we're getting booed, we're doing our best, and you guys need
best.
To rally behind your country instead of booing us.
Yeah, and I said nobody knew that these guys were as good as
right.
they are.
Right, nobody, not even the fans or anybody. There was no
and
internet
I
then.
Says, maybe we weren't prepared, and we weren't. I says, but listen, we're going over to Russia, and we're going over to win. We're becoming a team.
So you went over to Russia 1-1-2. Two losses, one tie, one win?
Well, we lost the first game.
Yeah, tied.
No, we
won
the second, won the third, won the fourth.
Oh, okay. So
we won 3 in a row.
Gotcha.
In the first game, we lost 6-5. we were up 5-3, and all of a sudden, penalties.
No, but in Canada, though, when you left Canada,
yeah.
What was your record when you left Canada?
One win, one loss, and one tie and two losses.
Two losses, right. So you go over to Russia
behind
the eight ball. So you mentioned before that when you went over there, the rooms were bugged. Like how? So you go to Russia. Tell us about like when you get there, what happened? Like, what were the
First we went to Sweden and played two exhibition games, and that's where we became a team.
Did you play the Swedes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, it was violent. There was a lot of, and Wayne Cashman got one of the worst injuries I've ever seen in my life. A guy, the Swedes filed their sticks down. Mm-hmm. Take a butter knife, and how the butter knife is filed at the point. It's not quite a point. That's how the Swedes file their sticks. And they'd spear you behind the knees or in your back. And it was unbelievable. This guy speared Cashman in the mouth and cut his tongue wide open like a snake. If he hadn't drank so much, he would have died.
Wow.
And his tongue swelled up. He still came with us. And he couldn't talk.
And you know how bad it is when you bite your tongue, how much that hurts.
I've done it. So we get to Russia. We were warned by the FBI and the mounted police that the rooms would be bugged. Be careful where we went. They don't screw around over there. Well, we were insane over there. We went to the Red Square. I'll never forget. The soldiers were lined up in Red Square. You couldn't get close to the Kremlin.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they were saying, and Peter Mihalovich, you know, screw you guys, up your ass. The guys have got guns. I said, Pete, they got guns. He said, who gives a shit? We're going after them anyway. And it was just crazy. We did find microphones.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
We found microphones. There's a story that went around that Cashman and I got blamed for. We found microphone in our room because Cashman, my roommate, we found it behind the mirror in the bathroom.
Wow.
And we found it one... The beds were foot to foot, bunk beds, foot to foot or head to head, whatever one. There were no chairs in the room. And they had a throw rug. And we were sitting, and we sat on the floor against the bed, like for a backstop.
Yeah.
So Cash couldn't play with the only American on the team, a guy named John Forrestal, who was our trainer.
Mm-hmm.
They went to the Marine base because he was a Marine, ex-Marine.
Yeah.
And they went to the Marine base in Moscow, and they'd come back just drunker than hell. So Cash came home one night with a bottle of homemade vodka.
Uh-huh.
Now, folks, if you ever taste the homemade vodka, it tastes like turpentine. And we put the bottle between us, and we sat on the floor, and we're drinking this, and Cash feels a lump in the throw rug. We threw back the throw rug, and there's a metal box with five screws, and Wayne gets up, and he goes to his shaving kit, and got a little penknife and started to unscrew these five screws. All the while I'm going, you commie son of a bitches, we're going to kill you, you commie bastard. And there was another little metal box with four screws. He unscrewed that too, and all of a sudden I hear this huge crash. I look through the hole. We unscrewed the chandelier in the ballroom. It cost us $3,800, which we didn't have, to fix it. And do you know that it's 2:30 in the morning?
Wow.
If that was 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the morning, we would have killed
people. Oh, yeah.
Because people would be dancing or eating.
Oh, yeah.
And they had that thing fixed by 8:30 in the morning.
Wow.
They had our phones where they would call at 3 o'clock in the morning, three or four times a night, five times a night, wake you up, and there would be nobody on the end. I remember pulling the phone out of the wall, and they came to fix it at 3 in the morning.
Wow.
They stole our food. I ate horse meat, bear, crow.
Really?
Oh, no.
Do you think they were doing that to mess with you guys so you would lose?
Of course. Absolutely.
Wow.
There's no doubt about it in my mind that they were doing whatever they could to take us off our game.
Wow. So how were those games when you started? How was the crowd? I mean, were they...
The crowd, if it wasn't for the Canadian crowd, they were yelling.
Canadians came over to watch.
We had about 2,500 Canadians that came over.
Oh, wow.
2,500.
So that helped.
They stayed in some shitty hotels, I can tell you that.
Sure, right?
They would tell me stories about some of the things with the bathroom at the end of the hall like you think about in Deadwood, for crying out loud, you know?
Yeah.
And, I mean... we were lucky. We had bathrooms at least. Mm-hmm. We stayed at a hotel called the Inn Tourist. You know what it is today in Moscow?
What?
It's the Ritz-Carlton.
Oh, is it?
It's a Ritz-Carlton. Now in Red Square, yeah. I played hockey in Red Square.
Wow.
And now there's a big, huge shopping mall on one side and the Kremlin's on the other. And you can walk right up to the Kremlin wall. Moscow is like being in New York, only more expensive.
Even back then, the 70s?
Now,
oh, okay, but in the 70s.
There, it was terrible.
Yeah.
There were no cars on the street. You very seldom saw cars. I saw these people lined up to go into what we call a grocery store. 10 o'clock, the door opened. And when they ran out of food, around 12:30, milk, bread, cheese, all that stuff, they shut the doors. If you got food, you got food. If you didn't, you didn't.
See you later, right?
See you later.
Yeah.
It was that crazy. It's so hard for people to understand the way it was. I mean, I have trouble believing it myself, and I went through it.
Hmm. Now, how about the games over there? Were they rougher in Russia? Was it getting pretty chippy?
Oh, big time.
Because you hear the story about Bobby Clark breaking the dude's leg. And
yeah, I mean, somebody said that to me. What do you think about Clarky when he broke the guy's ankle, Karmelov's ankle? I said, the only thing I was pissed off about, he didn't do it in the first game. Should have done it in the first game.
Now, you mentioned the refereeing. Was the officiating, were they Russians?
Awful. East Germans.
So still under the umbrella.
There was a guy named Kampala. He wasn't supposed to referee the eighth game and final game. We had agreed on the referees because I was kind of privy with Harry. I don't know. He kept asking me, and I was a captain, one of the captains. So, and he said, okay, Campella's got to go out. I said, we can't have that guy. This guy calls penalties. Look at all these games when he referees, we lost.
Yeah.
Because we were in a penalty box like 15, 20 minutes every game.
Right.
Against them. You know, you couldn't do that. So Campola was not supposed to referee. They had agreed on referees. All of a sudden, we show up. We're in warm-up, and we find out Campola is. We all congregate over by our bench, and I'll never forget this guy, the minister of sports for the Russians. No emotion. He had no emotion. He just stood there, letting on he didn't understand a word. While Eagleson and Harry were going crazy, arguing with them about the officials.
Wow.
And they ended up coming to me and saying, we're stuck with this guy. I said, let's get out of here.
Yeah.
Screw him. We got our money. Let's go. He said, but we'll lose. Who cares? Let's go. Call or bluff.
Said, this is before game eight. This is before the final game.
This is before the final game. We decided we're going to play anyway. And Campella, true to form, with Jean-Paul Parisi, one referee, no penalty. The other referee calls a penalty. And not only that, he gives him a 10-man misconduct. And JP, I thought he was going to hit him with the stick. He got the stick back, and he was going to swing it at him. And Peter stepped in, and I stepped in, and they threw him out of the game. And JP got thrown out of the game. And he has never, in all the years he played in the NHL, all the years he played anywhere, he never got kicked out of a game.
Only because of the circumstances surrounding what was going on. Yeah.
But you know one thing I found out about him?
What's that?
We could intimidate him, and I did. I used to say to him things that I can't say even on this. And he'd look at me, and I knew he understood me. Because I said, someday I'll get you. I said to him.
To the referee of the international game.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is how.
It was war.
But that's exactly. It was war. Things were different then. Like you said, people can't understand just how monumental the game was. And I like what you said earlier on where you thought, it's just an all-star game. We're just screwing around.
That's what
but
we thought.
Each game, it got more and more serious where you're playing for your life.
And I mean, these people, there's no doubt about it. The people were fine. It was politics. Then I got pissed off. I got pissed off at our government and I got pissed off at the Russians. They used us as political footballs. Eagleson used us because he was a conservative and liberals were in power. That's Trudeau was
That's right,
prime
yeah.
minister then.
Canadian government, yeah.
And I remember landing in Montreal after the whole tournament because people don't know. We went to Czechoslovakia and played in Prague after that.
Wow.
An exhibition game because of Stan Mikita.
Oh, this is after the...
Yeah, and they were still communists, and Stan had gotten out. But we went back and played.
Stan defected.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And we played. We tied 3-3 that game. Mm. I got my nose broken. and we tied 3-3. Serge Savard scored in last 30 or 40 seconds. But half of us guys don't even remember playing in that game, you know? The emotion of winning. Well,
it's
Russia.
Just like the 1980 Lake Placid. They didn't beat the Russians for the gold medal.
It was Finland.
It was Finland, but everyone thinks it was because that's how big of a monumental game it was. So tell us about that last goal that scored. I know it was Paul Henderson that scored it, but I mean, you guys are right near the end at the wire. I mean, couldn't have written a better story. Best of eight, one of the games ends in a tie, so now it's 3-3 basically.
That's right.
With the tie, and this is the winning game.
Well, I'll go a little quicker there by saying with about a minute to go,
mm-hmm.
apparently the minister of sports, the guy that had that stoic, no-look
face, emotion,
said at our bench, he came to the bench and said to John Ferguson, assistant coach, if it's a tie, we declare victory because we have one more goal in you. And Fergie told him to F off and get out of there. You know, Fergie would.
That's right.
And then that last shift, I played, I think they told me I played about 46, 47 minutes that game.
Mm-hmm.
I had such faith in myself that I was going to get it done mm-hmm. one way or another. Mm-hmm. And when we went into the third period, we were down 5-3.
Okay.
And we ended up tying at 5-5. I think I got a goal and assist. And that last shift, for some reason, Paul Henderson was yelling at Peter Mihalovic to come off the ice. Yelling
Why?
At him. Paul said he had this epiphany. Yeah, you know?
Yeah.
That and Paul had become very, very religious after this. No,
afterwards.
Series, because he really believes that God put him there for this particular purpose. And, you know, who am I to say no?
Well, that? Yeah, exactly, right? If he's
you
feeling
know what
it.
I mean? If that's how he
Divine
feels.
Divine intervention.
That's right. And he was yelling at Peter to come off, and Peter left and went off. And Paul skated towards the net. I take a shot. Tretiak makes the save. Paul gets tripped up. He's behind the net. He fell down. Liapkin, I think his name was, fumbles the puck. It goes right to the faceoff dot to the right mm-hmm. of Tretiak. And as I'm skating away, I snap my wrist and I get it right on the net. In the meantime, Paul had fallen down, so they lost track of him. And he comes back out in the front, and Tretiak, for some unexplained reason, kicked the rebound straight out in the front, and there was Paul with 34 seconds left, and he put it in the net. I tell you, that's as close as I came in my life to kissing another guy. I told him that, too. I mean, I couldn't believe it. And when he scored that goal, it was pure elation, but there was still 34 seconds left.
Mm, right.
And Harry looks at me, and I said, I'm not coming off.
Mm-hmm.
And the other guys on the team, later on in life, they started to bust my balls about it. And they had a right to.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, I felt like I was possessed, okay?
You don't want to lose control of the game because, like you said, you thought...
I had faith in myself that it was going to happen. That I wasn't going to let them score.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
No matter what. And whatever, if they pulled the goalie, then we'd get empty net goal for sure. So basically when we won, I skated by the Russian bench, and Boris Kulagin was one of the coaches. And this guy, his head was as big a head as you ever seen in your life.
Bison
and he
head.
Was a big guy and a round head. And as I skated by and he never smiled, I went, hey, Chuckles, stick that in your ass. And he just looked at me. And they understood us, by
but
the way.
His ass. They let oh, did on. They? Really?
They let on. They couldn't understand English. They understood every word we were saying.
Yeah, if they've been training since they were 12 years old, you know English was part of it.
You bet you.
You know, I went through that a couple times in Japan wrestling, where the Japanese guys would never really understand what you're talking
they
about.
Understood.
Meanwhile, they understood everything exactly. Now, I mean, it's probably hard to judge, but was that one of the biggest moments of your career?
Well, it was.
Yeah.
In a sense that... I believed it was a war,
mm-hmm.
and I believe it was our society against their society, mm-hmm. and I didn't like the fact that we were thrown into this political football.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want that. Mm-hmm. Communism against capitalism.
Because you didn't sign up for that.
No, right. We didn't want to be part of that.
Mm-hmm.
When we came back after that series and won, we landed in Montreal, and we were in no shape to even get off the... Because we had drank the whole way, and they finally sent a charter for us. We took a regular flight over to Moscow. They didn't give us a charter.
Really?
No. But we won, so they sent an Air Canada.
Thankfully, you won, right?
Yeah, charter to get us home. And Wayne Cashman and Tony were sitting with me. And Cash still couldn't talk much because of his tongue. And quite frankly, if he hadn't drank so much, he probably would have dropped dead. You know?
In what way do you mean?
Well, his tongue was so swollen he couldn't eat.
Oh, I see.
And he was drinking milkshakes, and then he'd drink beer and vodka. Vodka. And my brother, too, and the three of us were sitting there. And as we landed, it was one of those 727s where the back, in the old days, they had the stairwell that could go down the back
yeah.
of the plane.
Right.
And then, of course, you had the front part of the plane where with the jetway. Anyway, Trudeau and the entourage were waiting at the back of the plane because that's where we were going to go out.
Did you land in Montreal or Toronto?
Montreal,
okay.
And Eagleson,
Trudeau's the Prime Minister of Canada.
And Eagleson said, to hell with that. We're going off the front of the plane, not the back of the plane. And for 15 minutes, negotiations went on which way we go off.
Hmm.
And I lost it.
Between who? Who was negotiating?
Eagleson was talking to
you guys.
Trudeau's friends or Trudeau's.
Why didn't
people.
You want to go out the back?
He wouldn't go out. He says, we don't go out the back. Oh. We go off the front. We go off like stars.
Yeah. And meanwhile, the Prime Minister of Canada is there to congratulate
Canada
you.
Because if it would have been a conservative, he would have done it.
Oh.
And me, I didn't give a crap whether a liberal or conservative. We didn't care about things like that. But I felt bad, and I said, screw it. I'm not getting off the plane, and neither is Cash and neither is Tony. Those guys couldn't get off the plane. Neither could I, probably.
Mm-hmm.
We had drank way too much. Trudeau came up that ramp, came to me, and the three of us were on that plane, and Trudeau, the four of us, and he shook my hand, and he said, thank you. On behalf of all of Canada, we thank you. You and your brother and Wayne, thank you very, very much for doing what you did. And I said, I'm sorry, Mr. Prime Minister. I says, but I couldn't get off because I didn't like the bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
He says, don't worry about it. I understand. Now we get on the plane again and go to Toronto. We land in Toronto and the Conservatives, a guy named Premier Davis.
Mm-hmm.
See, Eagleson had aspirations of running for prime minister.
Oh
yeah. That.
And meanwhile, Eagleson was ripping off the NHL players.
He was ripping us off. But we didn't understand mm-hmm. that at the time, you know. Mm-hmm. We really didn't. None of us did. And your dad's pension
yeah.
and my pension sucks compared to other sports.
That's right.
It sucks.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, it's great. They get $10,000 a year of service. You play 10 years, you get $100,000 at 45 for life.
Yeah.
If you want to take it then, you know?
Right.
And not on our day.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get to Toronto. Now the same thing happens with Premier Davis and the Conservatives.
The PCs.
And we all do this all this bullshit at the and up making speeches and all that. And then I'm going, what is going on? So we go and stayed at the Sutton Place in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And I get a call from the mayor of Sault Ste. Marie. He says, Phil, I want you and Tony to come up. We're going to do a big parade and all that. And I said, I don't know whether I'll talk to Tony. I'll get back to you. I get off the phone and my brother says, I'm not going. I'm going home.
Hmm.
I want out of here. I had enough. I want to go back to Chicago, and I want to play in the NHL, and that's all I want to do. No more parties, no more this, no more that. And I called the mayor back up. It was John Rhodes. And I said, and I knew Rhodesy for years. I said, Johnny, we're not coming. He said, but Phil, we got this big parade and everything planned for you. I said, I'm sorry, we're not coming. My brother doesn't want to go, and I'd be damned if I'm going without him.
Mm-hmm.
And I would I've gone? Because of my mom and dad, I would have gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would have gone because of my mom and dad, but not because of the city or anything else. And my brother, when he said no, I couldn't do this to him. I did it to him by playing in
Yeah, by dragging him in there,
and
yeah.
I couldn't do it to him. So we decided to go. And I remember I got back to Boston. They didn't give one crap about this series. New York didn't care. Chicago didn't care. That's all he cared was in Canada.
It was a purely Canadian thing.
It was a purely Canadian thing.
And it's a legendary Canadian moment.
Because we were called Team Canada.
That's right, right. Good point.
It was just, but that was the whole idea. It was going to be the send-off for Eagleson to get into politics.
Hmm.
I'm convinced of that.
Wow. Phil, there's so much more we could talk about, but I'm going to ask you one more question.
Sure.
All the goals you scored, 717 goals, is there one that still stands out as like one of your favorite goals? If you had to choose one, is it even possible to do?
Probably the first one.
I don't know.
It's the only one that really I think about. I mean, I have no idea where I scored my 700th point. Mm-hmm. I don't know where I scored my last goal.
Mm-hmm.
I remember my 59th and 60th. For the first, they were in Los Angeles. My luck. There was nobody covering anything out there. But, you know, Chris, and all said and done, the greatest thing I've ever done in the game was get the Tampa Bay Lightning.
Hmm.
I was so out of my element. Mm-hmm. And that would be great for another show if you want.
Absolutely.
I'd love
we
to
could do a couple more shows.
I'll do it with you. And the thing was that to get this franchise, the sacrifices that I had to make, including a marriage, I sold my house in New York on a golf course. I played golf with this guy, and he wanted to buy my house, and I told him the price, and he says, nah, and he told me $100,000 less, and he says, I'll tell you what, let's play golf for the $100,000. I looked at him like, are you crazy? I said, how many shots are you going to give me? He said, what's your handicap? I said, 12. He said, well, I'm a 6, so I give you 6 shots. I beat the shit out of him. You shouldn't have put that money up there. But and I sold the house and went back and told my wife that we're going to Florida. And that was way before we even knew we were going to get a franchise. Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
And she wasn't very happy and caused a lot of problems.
Yeah. But like you said, it's become you were one of the greatest players of all time in hockey as a player, and now as a builder.
I would be more proud of being in the Hall of Fame as a builder than as a player.
Yeah, you're almost
does that
like
make sense?
Absolutely, it does. It to me, it's almost like the words escape me right now, but. Like when you go into the wilds of Africa as a Christian and try and get people to become
change.
Christians,
yeah.
You're doing that. You're beating down the kind of the barriers of hockey in that it can only be a northern sport.
Well,
you know?
That's all they thought.
You're
that's
like a Jesuit
thought.
Priest going into the
but
wilds.
For me, I've been a lucky, lucky guy. I played in Chicago first. That was a whole different life.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was in Boston. That was a different life. Boston, New York was about the same kind of life.
Similar, yeah.
And then when I moved down here, it was a different life, and I got married again.
Mm-hmm.
And who the hell ever thought I would marry a girl from the Tampa Bay area that never even saw a hockey game before, who now I can't get her to stop watching it. But it's been a great time, and Tampa Bay is paradise.
Yeah.
It
absolutely.
Is.
And turned into a pretty good hockey town too. So
has your dad ever been down here?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, he comes down quite often. You know, absolutely.
Like, and he still wants to go back to Winnipeg.
Winnipeg for life, I guess.
Teddy.
Phil, thank you so much, man. You're Chris. A legend and one of my favorite players of all time, and I would love to have you back again.
I'd love to do it with you. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thanks to Phil Esposito for an amazing show, and thanks to all of you for using my Amazon link every time you do your online shopping. Very easy to find. Go to podcastone.com, click on the Keep Our Podcast Free banner at the top of the page, and then click on Talk is Jericho, and you'll see all three of my Amazon links, Amazon Canada, Amazon UK, Amazon USA. Everybody's going to Amazon, Amazon USA. Every time you do that, Amazon kicks back a little cash to the show so we can keep doing this for you for free twice a week. No extra fees or hidden charges. You're just getting your shopping done and helping me out in the process, keeping the dream alive, keeping everything rocking. All right, next week, big week. I got a two-part interview with, the world heavyweight champion. Daniel Bryan will be on this show Wednesday and Friday. You are going to love it. I'll see you next week. God bless you and a big yeah, boy. Yeah.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.
You're listening to Love Advice with Leanne. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Leanne. Longtime listener, first time caller. Why, in your professional opinion, do you never take my calls off the air?
Is this Carl?
Yep, it's Carl. I mean, we had a few dates. Everything was great, I thought.
Well, you know, when you switch to GEICO, you could save a lot of money on car insurance.
Okay, awesome.
You should call them.
I will.
GEICO, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
Syria Peace Talks? I'm Ben Thomas with an AP News Minute. Syrian rebels have rejected peace talks being proposed by Russia. They're accusing Moscow of failing to pressure its ally, President Bashar Assad, to end the conflict. Christmas may be over, but the shopping isn't. Hazel Ginn was at Macy's Herald Square in New York today.
It's not too bad. Even we went up to the 9th floor, and we managed to get in a queue of about 4 deep, so not bad. Yeah, and then we went to another one, and it was only a couple, so we kind of timed it well, I think.
America's research group, which focuses on consumer behavior, projects holiday sales up about 5% this year. Harley Davidson is placing a renewed emphasis on teaching people to ride as part of its efforts to attract more customers. The company is expanding the number of dealerships with a Harley Riding Academy. The move comes as the industry grapples with years of declining sales and an aging customer base. I'm Ben Thomas.